Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Jeffrey Sussman, author of the new book, Max Baer and Barney Ross, Jewish Heroes of Boxing. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevinah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim Barel Kachar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We celebrated Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israeli Independence Day, last week, Israel's 69th birthday. And in 2.5 weeks, on May 25th, we'll rejoice on Yom Yerushalayim, the day that commemorates the reunification of the city of Jerusalem in 1967. This will mark the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War and the remarkable, miraculous Israeli victory that allowed Jews to return to the holiest place on earth for us, the Kotel, the Western Wall, and to the old city of Jerusalem. This anniversary, while extraordinary, is of course also controversial. Today and over the next few shows, we'll look at what that 50th anniversary means today. We'll start this morning by remembering what Israel was before the Six-Day War and the precariousness of its very existence. It's hard to fathom now, 5 full decades later, but in the mid-1960s, the tiny Jewish state was surrounded by a cordon of enemies sworn to destroy it. Well, that's still semi-true, but they also seem to have the power and will to actually do so, which is not true today. Gamal Abdel Nasser had unified the Arab world, or at least Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, into a confederation that fully intended to drive the Jews into the Mediterranean Sea and annihilate Israel. In the midst of the Cold War, Russia armed the Arabs with the latest weapons and a huge armory of MiG jets and tanks and big guns. In contrast, the U.S. was only very tepidly supporting Israel, whose closest ally then was France. Israel survived on its wits, its dedication to build a Jewish state, the support of Jews around the world, and the simple fact that the Jews in Israel had nowhere else to go. The borders of Israel were set at the armistice lines as they existed at the end of the very costly War of Independence in 1948. In the middle of the country, just north of Tel Aviv, in fact, the entire width of the nation of Israel was less than 9 miles. A brisk tank invasion from Jordan right there would have cut the country in half in less than an hour. The capital of Israel was then, as now, Western Jerusalem, the new city, which Jews built starting in the 19th century. But many parts of Jerusalem were within shooting range of snipers and the Jordanian army, making whole sections of the eastern edge of the city virtually uninhabitable. In 1967, at least up until June, you could purchase land on King David Street very inexpensively because it simply wasn't safe. That's, in fact, how Hebrew Union College came to be located down the block from the ritzy King David Hotel. You were likely to get shot if you weren't careful there. Gallows humor was the order of the day for Israelis. In those days, the Israeli economy was a shaky thing indeed. The old joke was, how do you make a small fortune in Israel? It's easy. Come with a large fortune. Israelis might have drained the swamps and planted forests, but they were confronted with huge, hostile Arab armies on every border and were isolated internationally. Israel was an amazing country even then, but it was also a very tough place to actually live. The build-up to the 1967 war was awful for Israelis. They knew that Nasser intended to attack sooner or later, and as he massed tanks and troops on the southern border with Egypt, Israeli society went into deep stress mode. Considering how stressed most Jews are most of the time, this is hard to fully imagine today. Remember, it was only about 20 years since the end of the Shoah. It was clear that in the coming conflict, brought on by the abiding Arab ambition to destroy the Jewish state and annihilate its population, Israel simply had to win, or there would likely be another Holocaust for Jews, this time in the Middle East. The pressure before what turned out to be the Six-Day War was so intense that as strong a man as Yitzhak Rabin, the chief of staff, actually had a nervous breakdown as he contemplated the military options and realized any failure would lead to absolute destruction. Most pre-war assessments saw Israel as extremely endangered. The Israeli Army and Air Force were well-trained, commanded, and unified, but they were vastly outnumbered, would have to fight on three different fronts, Egypt to the south, Jordan to the east, Syria, and likely Lebanon in the north. We know now that after Egypt mobilized against Israel, as did Syria and Jordan, the Israeli Air Force launched an attack that destroyed the enemy while it was on the ground. We know now that in a lightning campaign, Israeli forces quickly routed the Egyptians and captured the whole Sinai Peninsula, including Sharm el-Sheikh, while the Egyptian army fled across the Suez Canal. We know that Israel responded to Jordanian attacks by driving the Jordanians from the old city of Jerusalem and its eastern suburbs, and that they quickly captured the whole west bank of the Jordan River. We know that Israeli troops conquered the Golan Heights and drove the Syrians out of their bunkers and sent them running back to Damascus. But none of that was predicted. It appeared as a near miracle at the time. Oh, heck, a miracle, full on. And when Israeli soldiers were photographed praying at the Kotel, the Western Wall, for the first time in decades, it was a truly amazing time for Jews everywhere in the world, unprecedented. That miraculous moment has to be remembered for what it was then, a period of intense relief, great pride, and amazing hope. Now, we thought, the Arabs must accept Israel and make peace. Now, Israel has become an established nation. It was one of the greatest military miracles in history, and it was a gift to Jews everywhere around the world. Suddenly, all young people wanted to move to Israel. Everyone thought that living on a kibbutz would be fabulous. Look at what those Israelis had done. That's what Jews should be like. That's where Jews should live. We'll explore the consequences of that moment and the subsequent 50 years of its impact over the next 3 weeks here on Too Jewish. But today, let's recall that incredible time in its own context. To play us in this morning, here's Benny Friedman's upbeat song, Yesh Tikvah. We have hope because God is with us. ושם מסביב לעולם יש צרות, דאגות, החיוך נעלם אך אל תראה רק שחור כי גם זה יעבור והכל יסתדר כי השם יעזור יש תקווה, נשיר כולנו יחד יש אמונה, חזקה מכל הפחד לא ניפול, לא נירד כי אנחנו לא לבד יש לנו השם צד יד ביד הקדוש ברוך הוא את כולנו אוהב עוד תראה שמחר ייגמר הכל יש תקווה אם נשאיר כולנו יחד יש אמונה חזקה מכל הפחד לא ניפול, לא נירד כי אנחנו לא לבד יש לנו השם That was Benny Friedman's Yesh Tikva. Our guest this morning, Jeffrey Sussman, has written a new book about a time and era when Jewish young men in America grew up poor with an overwhelming need to prove themselves to an often anti-Semitic society. Some of them did it in the boxing ring and rose to become champions. Learn about them, two in particular, Barney Ross and Max Baer, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Jeffrey Sussman, the author of 10 nonfiction books and many articles and short stories about what is sometimes called the sweet science of boxing. His new book is called Max Baer and Barney Ross, Jewish Heroes of Boxing. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
All right. So what kind of a job is this for a nice Jewish boy?
Well, the way I got started in this, I always have been writing my whole life, but the way I became interested in boxing was that when I was 12 years old, I was a short, skinny kid, and my father was worried that older and bigger boys would pick on me. And my father had grown up in a tough immigrant neighborhood in Queens, New York, and learned to defend himself against kids who were particularly anti-Semitic. This was in the 1920s and 30s, and got into a lot of fights, and thought that I should know how to defend myself. So when I was 12, he brought home a speed bag, a heavy bag, a jump rope, and a pair of boxing gloves, and he set it up in the basement and taught me the elements of boxing. He then decided that he would get a professional to give me additional lessons. And he knew a man named Lou Stillman, who owned a famous boxing gym in New York City called Stillman's Gym, where a lot of professional boxers trained. And there, for $100, he hired an Italian middleweight fighter to give me 10 boxing lessons. And I became enamored of this. And after the 10 lessons, I was a little too full of myself, and I said to the fellow who was training me, his name was Nick, I said, oh, I'd love to get in the ring and spar with someone. And he said, you're crazy, kid. If you get into the ring, someone's going to kill you. So that was really the end of my boxing career. But my father also had a best friend when he was growing up, a man named Abe Simon. And my father told me a story that he and Abe and a number of boys belonged to a Jewish social club. And Abe was an enormous person by the time he was a senior in high school. He was 6'4" and weighed about 230 pounds and had been considering a career as a professional football player when he graduated from high school. One night, on a Saturday night at this social club, they were having a dance, and four kids were outside who belonged to something called the German-American Bund, with the American-German Bund. I'm not sure which the name came first. And they were shouting anti-Semitic slurs and threats and demanding that the Jews come out and fight with them. Well, Abe went out, and he immediately knocked out two of them, and he got into a fist fight with the third one and beat him up. And the fourth one ran away, shouting that there was a Jewish maniac on the loose and people should watch out. Abe, instead of going on to be a football player, went on to be a prize fighter because he came from a poor immigrant family and he could make a lot more money as a prize fighter than he could as a football player. And he was fairly successful. He went on to challenge Joe Louis for the heavyweight title twice. He lost both times in 1940 and 1941. and then became an actor and appeared in several movies, probably the most famous one was On the Waterfront. But I heard these stories about Abe, and I met Abe when I was a boy, and that further fascinated me about boxing. And then in the late 1980s, I was working for a marketing public relations advertising firm in New York City, and one of our clients was a sports promoter, and his client was an Olympic gold medalist boxer named Howard Davis, and it became my job to promote Howard Davis's bouts with other fighters, and he was on ABC Wide World of Sports and other programs, and I used to go to a gym where he trained called the Times Square Gym and watch him work out, and I became fascinated by all of this. Anyway, one day I was telling a friend of mine who's a former English teacher named Peter Wood these stories, and Peter Wood, as a young man, had been a Golden Gloves boxer. And he said, why don't you start writing for Boxing.com? You have a lot of interesting stories to tell. And I was writing for them, and I wrote probably 15 or 18 articles and short stories. And as I was doing this, I started researching Max Baer and Barney Ross, because it fit in with my background of my father's encounters with anti-Semites, of Abe Simon, and so forth. And I discovered that Max Baer was the only Jewish heavyweight champion of the 20th century. And Barney Ross was the first fighter to hold three titles simultaneously. And they were both promoted as Jewish fighters, and they became symbols for Jews in the 1930s of heroism against anti-Semitism. And both of them wore Stars of David on their trunk to let the world know that they were in fact Jewish, and that they were fighting on behalf of the Jews. In 1933, my father went to see Max Baer fight Max Schmeling, Hitler's favorite boxer, at Yankee Stadium, and he said there were about 60,000 fans in the stadium that day, and he thought that by the reaction that Max Baer got, that probably 30,000 of them were Jews. Because when Max Baer took off his robe and they could see the Star of David on his trunks, a big cheer erupted from the audience. And he beat up Max Schmeling so badly that the referee had to stop the fight in the 10th round. And another cheer went up from all the Jewish fans. And it was extraordinary because here was a man who was fighting as a Jew on behalf of Jews, and Max Schmeling was a symbol of the Aryan Superman, Hitler's favorite boxer, who was defeated by a Jew. It made Jews in New York feel wonderful. It made them feel that they had a champion, a hero that they could admire and have tremendous respect for. And I was excited by that, and so I decided to write this book.
We will talk much more with Jeffrey Sussman, the author of Max Baer and Barney Ross. We'll get to Max Baer, Barney Ross, and Benny Leonard when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's very popular podcast. They're free, and they're the top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked a little broadly last week about this apparent trend internationally towards authoritarianism. And you mentioned a few specific places. France, where Marine Le Pen has risen. We talked about Hungary briefly. Certainly could see it in the in Russia, Turkey. But it's not a few places, actually.
Right. And some places have actually never left the
authoritarianism,
path of dictatorship. Yeah. I mean, you think of our next door neighbor, Cuba. Think of North Korea and how menacing its nuclear program is. Why we worry so much about Iran and so little about North Korea is beyond me.
Yeah. In fact, some of the stuff that Iran has gotten, they've gotten from North Korea.
Right. But if you want to talk about Europe and places that have still significant Jewish communities, and of course Iran once did, but no longer does, Turkey is a good and very disquieting case in point, if for no other reason than because it's a NATO ally, traditionally a strong friend of the United States, and a great country full of wonderful people, including many friends of mine.
Absolutely. So, and at times, an ally of Israel's besides.
Right. And a large and still dynamic Jewish community.
Right.
It was Sultan Bayezid who sent boats to invite Jews who were fleeing from Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492 to come and settle in Turkish territories, and who said to his prime minister, this Spanish king must be a fool to get rid of the people who are making him so wealthy. So Turkey traditionally, whether under the Ottomans or the post-Ottoman regimes, has been friendly, more than merely tolerant of Jews, but actually friendly. And Erdogan, I don't think, is running on a platform of anti-Semitism or a platform of moving Turkey away from its traditional welcome and tolerance of other religions. I do think he's trying to concentrate a lot of power in the presidency, which was supposed to be a non-political position, abolishing the prime ministry, basically abolishing the independence of the judiciary and the existence of a free press. So I think he's...
I think I heard a statistic, 30% of the jailed journalists in the world are now in Turkey, which is mostly in recent times since the failed coup.
The Turkish press used to be very free. In fact, some would argue too free, in the sense that it was irresponsible and not held liable for any sort of libel or slander or whatever. But now it seems that Turkey has taken a definitive turn towards paternalism or authoritarianism, whatever. And you have to ask yourself the question of, is this not the inevitable result of rapid urbanization, rapid social change, a sort of being dragged back by conservatives and by really peasants from Central Anatolia to more traditional lifestyles, which included an authoritarian figure for many centuries, the Sultan.
Yeah, I mean, thinking of Erdogan as the new Turkish Sultan is, and he is a very devout guy, apparently. It's troubling. And we'll look at some other areas where this trend seems to be going. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to that.
We welcome our Shin Bar El Kahar, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Israel had a big birthday this week.
True.
Yom HaAtzmaut, a huge celebration. We Woo. Think about, oh, the big national celebrations. You can see them on TV. You can see them on YouTube. Big festivals. But actually, you know, people celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, in their own communities. Tell us about your community.
That's true. So apart from all the huge fireworks we do have, but it's not as big like here, 4th of July. I know people go crazy. But in where I live in Shimshit in Israel, it's a small community of only 2,500 people. And what we do is we basically, at night, we start about 6, 7, and we would just have plays about Israel and taking David Ben-Gurion, taking Yitzhak Rabin, and talking about those people and like having spoofs about them and funny plays. Or we just take songs and sing them. Possibly every year the same 5 songs we do.
Of course. Yeah. Which songs do you sing?
So we sing Shir LaShalom in the end, always, because that always has to be the song. We sing, I forget the name of it, but it's this the song that comes in every Israeli movie ever. Every Israeli, there's Israeli movies are called Tirtei Burekas, like movies from
the Burekas,
you know,
movies.
Cult movies. Yeah, yeah, I forget the name of it, but basically we get the
ethnic
same
movies. Right?
Yes,
yeah,
perfect example of it. And basically, what we do is we take the people from the community, from Shimshit, and we just sing and talk, and sometimes we bring a performer from outside, and we just have a big celebration.
But that actually costs money, so mostly you stick to the people from within the community.
Well, not that poor, but sometimes we bring someone from outside. And then we have just a lot of booths that you can buy some stuff, like all these kind of magnets, and it's like colorful, you know, all
the
these
festival stuff.
Yeah, like you'd buy a lightsaber here, you know, but it's all part of Israel. It's all branded on Israel, and you can. And at the end of the night, you end up with this T-shirt that you don't know how you got for like 1,000 shekel, you know? Right. it's really funny.
It sounds like kind of a cross between a big picnic and a celebration. Do you have a parade too?
Well, we had a parade once, but it took so long, so we stopped doing
parades
it.
Parades
always take so long.
I'm going to confess that I think parades are incredibly boring. But
you
but
mean
don't
those
tell
are,
anybody
not
that
those
I just
Temple
said
Manual,
that.
Right? Not
no,
those.
No. Of course, ours are great, but I mean, you know, like I'd rather watch a show. I'd rather sing songs, do plays.
So we understood that it's much too long. So
yes,
we didn't
of
do
course.
It.
When we talk about Yom HaTzmaut, do Israelis all feel a great sense of pride? I mean, and I want to, you can't generalize for every single Israeli, but in America, a lot of people are proud on the 4th of July, but a lot of people are also just happy to, you know, go to the sales and make it a day off.
Yes, yeah, so a great thing about it is that it comes one day after Yom HaZikaron, which is the Remembrance Day. So one day before, you remember a lot of the soldiers and all of the soldiers that have fought for Israeli wars. And then afterwards, you have this great feeling of winning, of great feeling of like accomplishment, that one day afterwards we celebrate Independence Day, which is the biggest victory ever in all these wars. So
it's great.
A great rush of win.
Yeah, there's something about what's still really a young country when you think about it. Not yet 70. It has some of that freshness. Thanks so much, Bar.
Thank you.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov, good morning.
Good morning. So we just celebrated Yom HaTzmaut, Israel Independence Day, Yom HaZikaron, Israel Memorial Day.
Right.
Important days, obviously they don't strike quite the same chord in the American public school calendar, but they sure do at THA, at day schools,
sure.
At synagogue schools.
You bet.
How do you teach it?
It's you know, these are really powerful holidays, and one of the things that's special about them is that they're more of a secular slash modern type of holiday, as opposed to one that we've been celebrating for thousands of years. So there's a lot of 20th and 21st century business associated with these holidays. So how do we teach it? First of all, Holocaust education is a very critical element of the curriculum and the program at THA. There are small components of it that children are exposed to over the years, and there's a heavy focus on it with our older kiddos, who are more capable of understanding and you know, handling the really heavy reality around the Holocaust. So at
like
seventh
the,
grade, there's a
right
very
with Yom HaShoah, Yom
it.
HaZikaron. I mean, these are painful subjects.
Absolutely.
What age is appropriate, kind of a tricky one, for teaching Holocaust?
Right. So we settle on seventh grade. Kids are about 13-ish. And so there's a maturity level there. And there's also years of learning under their belts and you know, especially in the upper school, reading literature, learning about history, learning about Judaics, that sets a good foundation to really get into this topic. But we also, you know, we teach it to the other grades as well. So one of the things that's neat is our kids put on learning types of plays, like instructional plays. So we have assemblies where the kids write, choreograph, develop song to teach a certain topic, and one of those is the Holocaust. So there's kind of a very somber, serious assembly where that mood is set, and our kids teach our kids some of the things that are important about learning about the Holocaust.
Oh, that's fascinating. And then do you do the same thing with Israel, for example? You know, stories about, I don't know, Chalutzim pioneers?
For sure, yeah. As we learn about Jewish history and the establishment of the State of Israel, those components are taught. But even in the youngest grades, we talk about Chalutzim and singing pioneer-type songs. Especially at THA, Yom HaTzmaut, Israel Independence Day, is just a blowout celebration. We dance. We wave the flag. We dance with the flag. We have this great thing where, you know, we kind of band together and toss each other up in the air.
Hopefully you catch each other as well.
We do. No one's been hurt yet. It's a massive party, and we're celebrating how great it is to have a nation as a Jewish people.
Great things to celebrate and to remember. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Peter, a tourist wandering through the Negev, gets lost and soon is tired and desperate for water. Just as he's about to give up hope, he sees a tiny oasis in the distance in the desert. Relieved, he walks up to it, but when he gets there, he's astonished to see a sign saying, Moshe's Thai Warehouse, and sitting there under a palm tree is Moshe himself, reading the Jerusalem Post. Next to him is a table with dozens of silk ties. Peter asks Moshe for some water, but Moshe says, I'm sorry, I don't have any water, but would you like to buy a tie? Peter answers, what good is a tie going to do me in the Negev Desert? I need water. You know, where you can stick your fancy ties. And Moshe says, look, it's no good being rude. You don't want a tie? Don't buy a tie. You're making a mistake, but it's your choice. Peter says, thanks for the advice, but where can I get water? I'm dying of thirst. Moshe answers, well, if you walk in that direction about 30 minutes, you'll come to a restaurant. It's owned by my brother Max. There, you can get plenty of water. Peter starts walking and disappears across the desert. An hour later, Peter crawls back to Moshe's Thai warehouse on his hands and knees. He's now extremely desperate for water. Moshe asks, what happened? Didn't you find Max's restaurant? Oh, I found the restaurant all right, gasps Peter. But Max wouldn't let me in without a tie. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and maybe wear a tie. And now a word of Torah. Emor, our Torah portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do with God giving commands to the people of Israel. But the language this time is a little different. Usually, commandments begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel, or occasionally tzav, command the children of Israel. This time, the much softer word emor, say to the priests, the children of Aaron, is used. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of that first sentence of our portion. It begins, say to the priests, and then adds, and say to them. The commentators do not believe the Torah is ever truly redundant. There is a subtle message here, the Talmud says. Be cautious in how we adults speak to children. Emor is a way of speaking softly and kindly. It's good advice in teaching children at any time, but why specifically is this word emor used twice in regard to the priestly commands? Priests, after all, are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness given to our ancestors, articulated so forcefully at the start of last week's portion of Kedoshim. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Here in Emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to a softer language is notable. Priests are the ones who actually have to help the people achieve holiness. They now must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements of it, but also inspired to do that work with devotion and passion. Thus, Emor, speak, explain, teach, inspire, not simply daber, tell, command, order, require. In leading somebody towards holiness, whether in ethics or spirit, there must be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality, but there must also be inspiration and care. Perhaps even especially a love for the process and the result of learning. This week of Emor, may we be inspired to seek holiness in our lives and in our Jewish practice, but also to seek to inspire others to do so as well, gently, caringly, lovingly. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Jeffrey Sussman, will tell us just what made Jewish champion boxers like Max Baer and Barney Ross so great, how it changed, and, well, what the lessons are when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Just one story this week in our news, but it's a very unusual one. A woman, Shoba Magdalena Friedman Nehru, a Hungarian Jew who narrowly escaped the Holocaust, married into India's leading political family and witnessed religious and ethnic violence convulse her native and adopted countries. Miss Nehru died last week in the Himalayan foothills at the age of 108. Shoba Nehru was known by her Hungarian nickname, Fori, but did not speak about her background much. After marrying the Indian diplomat, Braj Kumar Nehru, in 1935, she took the name of Shoba, dressed in saris, and was thoroughly assimilated. Acquaintances took her for a pale-skinned India from Kashmir. As a member of the Nehru household, she grieved beside the bodies of Mahatma Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, and Rajiv Gandhi, all of whom were assassinated. Shoba Nehru typically stayed away from political matters, but she took the unusual step of confronting Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, her close friend and cousin by marriage, when she believed that the state of emergency that Gandhi declared in 1975 had gone too far in rolling back human rights in India. She later recalled presenting Gandhi with a list of men who had been forced to undergo mass sterilization in a campaign headed by Gandhi's son, Sanjay. Expecting to encounter resistance from the prime minister, she had asked each man for his individual telephone number. That kind of courage was remarkable, but Nehru was an unusual person. I guess she was like that, her husband Ashok Nehru said. She felt she had to get the truth across to Indira Gandhi. It was a close family relationship, not a political relationship. She felt free enough to do that. Shobhan Nehru was 90 when she asked an Oxford classmate of her son's, British historian Martin Gilbert, to suggest reading material on the history of the Jews. Gilbert later wrote that he was perplexed by that, having seen her as an Indian woman. And then she told the story of her childhood in Budapest. Auntie Fori wanted to learn the history of the people to whom she belonged, but from whom 67 years earlier she had moved away to the heat, dust, and challenge of India, Martin Gilbert wrote in his book Letters to Auntie Fori, The 5,000-Year History of the Jewish People and Their Faith. Shobhan Nehru was born in 1908 in a prosperous, assimilated Jewish family. It had changed its surname from Friedman to the less Jewish-sounding Forbath. Her mother's family was one of the few Jewish families licensed under the Austro-Hungarian Empire to use the aristocratic prefix von. She had rarely gone to a synagogue except to pick up her father after services. But an anti-Semitic tide was rising in Hungary after World War I. The family was forced to revert to the name of Friedman. In 1919, hoping to stave off a communist revolution, right-wing mobs roamed the streets, killing Jews. By the time Shobhan Nehru was 20, strict quotas had been introduced for Jewish students in Hungarian university. Her parents sent her to the London School of Economics, where she met B.K. Nehru, a member of a distinguished Indian family whose cousin, Jawaharlal, was already a leader of the Indian independence movement. He later became India's first prime minister. Her parents were skeptical of the match, Nehru recalled. How could their beautiful and lovely daughter marry a black man in a distant country of which they knew nothing, and who by his own confession belonged to a family of jailbirds? His parents were skeptical too, but when the two sets of parents met in Budapest, there was a thaw. They were sitting in the sitting room, Shobhan Nehru said later. I was crying in my bedroom. My future mother-in-law came by my room, saw me crying, and said, we must let them do what they want to do. The Hungarian bride stepped off a ship in India in a sari and never looked back. As part of a countrywide tour, she was taken by her future mother-in-law to the prison where Jawaharlal Nehru was being held by the British. Seeing her in tears, he sent her a gently chastising letter saying, Nehru's don't cry in public. They keep a stiff upper lip. Meanwhile, her relatives and friends in Hungary scattered. Her father was saved by his German housekeeper. Her brother, an officer in the Hungarian army, swam the Danube to Czechoslovakia. Her best friends smuggled across the border with her son hidden in the trunk of a car. Nehru did not return to Hungary until 1949. She was born, however, a Hungarian Jew and remembered her roots until Shobhan Nehru died last week at the age of 108. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guests this morning. Jeffrey Sussman's new book is called Max Baer and Barney Ross, Jewish Heroes of Boxing. Jeffrey Sussman has written 10 nonfiction books. He's a regular writer and has published broadly on a variety of subjects, but in particular boxing. He's president of a public relations and marketing firm in New York City. So tell us a little bit about Benny Leonard, because he's sort of the pioneer in all of this, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Benny Leonard grew up on the Lower East Side in New York, and he was a small, skinny little kid, and other kids used to pick on him. And he started going to a boxing gym that a lot of Jewish immigrants were going to on the Lower East Side called the Fondor Gym, where he learned to box, and he became what was called the first scientific boxer. He was so good at understanding the offensive and defensive strategies of his opponents that he was able to out-strategize them and overcome them and win in a kind of very scientific way. And he was so good at this that it was said that after a fight, he didn't so much as have a hair on his head misplaced.
And he was kind of a dapper guy out of the ring, too, eventually, wasn't he?
Yes. He, when people saw him, you know, dressed in a tailored suit, they thought he was a haberdasher's model. He was elegant and natty and quite a charming fellow. And he was, you know, very good to his family. He supported them. He supported those around him. And unfortunately, when the depression came and the stock market crashed in 1929, he lost all of his money, and he had to return to boxing, first as a boxer and then as a referee. He was a favorite, incidentally, of my grandfather, who came to this country in 1905 after his father, a rabbi, had been killed in a pogrom in Russia. And my grandfather settled on the Lower East Side. And my grandfather had three interests other than theological ones. One was art, one was opera, and the third one was boxing. Because he felt that if the Jews in Russia had learned to box, they may have been able to defend themselves against some of the Cossacks who attacked their villages. And so he wound up going to the same boxing gym that Benny Leonard trained at. And my grandfather used to love to watch Benny Leonard. My grandfather knew he didn't have those kinds of skills, but he loved to watch Benny Leonard. And in fact, he attended a fight where Benny Leonard was the referee. It was the last fight that Benny Leonard participated in, and Benny Leonard had a heart attack during that fight and died in the center of the ring. And my grandfather went to his funeral, which was held at a place called Riverside Chapel here in New York, and he said people just wept. I mean, they loved Benny, and they were so sad to see what happened to him, the way he died in the ring of a heart attack.
You know, Jews being in the boxing ring seems an anomaly, but when you understand that most boxers come out of poor backgrounds, tough neighborhoods, Jews were immigrants and very poor in the first part of the 20th century, makes a little more sense. That wasn't true for everybody. Max Baer wasn't a Lower East Side kid or anything, was he?
No, he came from a... he was brought up on a ranch in Northern California. And but it was a poor ranch. It wasn't, and his family was certainly not wealthy. His father used to pay him 35 cents a night to go around and collect garbage from the restaurants after they closed at 3 o'clock in the morning, bring the garbage back to the ranch, and feed the pigs and other animals that they had on the ranch. Well, one night, Max Baer and some friends went to a dance. And they saw a pickup truck parked outside the dance. And in the back of the pickup truck, there was a jug of wine. This was during Prohibition. And he and his friends polished off the contents of that jug of wine. And the owner of the pickup truck and the jug of wine saw them. He was a very large lumberjack. And he took out after these kids, and the kids started running away from him. And Max Baer was at the end of this line of kids running away. And the lumberjack caught him by his collar and spun him around and punched him on the nose. It had absolutely no effect on Max Baer, but instinctively he reared back with his right fist and punched the lumberjack on the chin and knocked him out, and the lumberjack lay on the ground unconscious for about 5 minutes. Well, a boxing promoter named Ansel Hoffman, who was also Jewish, saw this and said to Max, "How would you like to become a professional boxer?" And Max said, "Well, you know, my mother is a big fan of Jack Dempsey, but I've never thought of boxing." And he said, "Well, you have a terrific right fist, and I think that you could be a very solid boxer." And he asked Max how much money he was making at the ranch, and he told him, and Ansel Hoffman laughed and said, "You know, well, we can start you off making $50 a fight, and if you have one fight a week, you'll earn $200 a month, which is a lot more than you're earning now." And Max Baer consulted with his mother, and his mother said, "Sure, go ahead and do it." And that was the beginning of Max Baer's career as a boxer.
He had a great career, and then tragically died of a heart attack, I think, at the age of 50.
50, correct.
Boxing is not the kind of profession where you think you're going to live a long time. Maybe the most fascinating story is Barney Ross's story. Can you tell that a little bit? I mean, also a war hero and then some tragedy in his life as well.
It was fascinating. His father was a Talmudic scholar on the Lower East Side and couldn't make a living. So he moved the family to a Jewish...
That's still often the case, I might add.
Yes, that's true. If you're going to be a Talmudic scholar, it's good to have a wealthy family to support you.
Indeed. Or at least a wife, it's possible.
Or a wife, yes. I know some like that. But he moved the family to a Jewish ghetto in Chicago called the Maxwell Street Ghetto. Barney, whose real name was... Beryl Rosofsky. He helped out his father in this little grocery store that he opened, which was maybe 400 square feet. And one day Beryl wasn't in this store. He was 15 years old, and two holdup men came into the store and shot his father and killed him. This completely disillusioned Beryl, as he was then known, about religion. His feeling was almost that where was God? Why didn't God protect my father?
Right.
Which is a normal feeling.
Response for a kid.
Yeah, absolutely. And so he stopped going to Hebrew school, and he started running around with a gang of tough young kids. One of whom, who became his best friend, was a kid named Jacob Rubenstein, who we better know today as Jack Ruby, the guy who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin of President Kennedy. And eventually these two boys became runners for Al Capone's bookie joints. And Al Capone took an interest in Beryl. He thought he was a nice kid. And he told him that he really wasn't cut out to be a gangster. This was not for him. On the other hand, he told Jacob Rubenstein that he was cut out to be a gangster. And as Beryl grew older, Al Capone suggested to him that because he was getting into all these fights on the street, that he might consider a career as a boxer. In addition to which, after Beryl's father had been killed, his mother had a nervous breakdown, was put into a mental institution, and his three siblings were all separated and put into foster care. And it became Beryl's ambition to make enough money to buy a home so that he could reunite his family. And Al Capone said he would help him do this. Al Capone got him a trainer, and when Beryl turned professional and changed his name to Barney Ross, so he would appear initially at least less Jewish, Al Capone made sure that all the tickets for his fights were sold because Barney would get a portion of the proceeds.
You know, there's so many great stories. It's a wonderful book. I just want to note that there's a famous story about Barney Ross on Guadalcanal, and it's a remarkable story. He probably should have won the Congressional Medal of Honor. He won the Silver Star for, I don't know, 13 or 14 hours holding off Japanese machine gunners, more or less by himself, to protect his group of Marines. Really, one story after another. I should note Max Baer Jr.'s son was on the Beverly Hillbillies. It was just such an incredible collection of information. The book is called Max Baer and Barney Ross, Jewish Heroes of Boxing. Incredible stories. I want to thank Jeffrey Sussman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. People can get it on Amazon and, of course, everywhere else. Where else can they go to find out more about you?
They can go to my website, which is powerpublicity.com, and also there's a brief bio with me on Wikipedia.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be prominent Israeli journalist Mati Friedman, author of the Aleppo Codex and the recent Lebanon War memoir, Pumpkin Flowers, also discussing media bias towards Israel. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli group Cafe Shachor Chazak, Strong Black Coffee Cafe, and their song Od Yom. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. ואלוהים ייקח בין הניצחונות להפסדים אני מחפש את המרווח כלום לא בחינם זה קודם תיתן ואז תיקח מה ששלי שלי וזה נשאר כך הכל פשוט אמנות הוא שנמות לא מסובך כל יום חוזר סחוט עם הילקות מרגיש מבורך זכות גדולה להתפרנס מהאהבה ולא אני לא מרגיש שאני הולך לעבודה זה זמן טוב לשים דגש לומר תודה לכל מי שבא לכל מי שקנה וכל מי ששנה תמשיך לסנוא אתה שם אני פה מגשים ומייצר לי חלומות ולאחר תראה לאט חבר הנה הכל מסתדר
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.